Coming up on Tech Nation, Ross King, whom you know from such books as Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling and Machiavelli. He's here today with Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet, and the Painting of the Water Lilies. Then on Biotech Nation, a whole new game for wearables. Noah Koenig from Cambridge Cognition and Ben Furnett from the Control Group talk about their new venture, Cognition Kit. How well are you actually doing on that medication? What's the bigger picture of your total status? Would you want to know that all the time? All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Once again, we ask, what's the difference between data and information? And the answer, again, is that information is data in context. This came to mind immediately during a recent European panel discussing the right to be forgotten versus the right to know. Or perhaps to better rephrase it, my right for you to forget everything I've ever done versus your right to know about it. Several years back, the European Court of Justice issued a ruling which compelled search engines to remove access to information which is inadequate, irrelevant, or no longer relevant in light of the time that has passed when asked by the individual. So there's the context of the objectionable data. The time that has passed with a sprinkling of inadequacy of information and or current relevance. And of course, whoever the information is related to must request that the access to it goes away. Now the search engines, well, they don't own the data. They only own the links to the data. So the right to be forgotten might better be described as the right to forget the links to any of that data about you. That, of course, is problematic. As a result of the 2014 ruling, Google has created a form and reportedly received some 500,000 requests at this writing, with roughly 43% deemed appropriate for removal. Google's online form, Search Removal Request under Data Protection Law in Europe, starts with the first overriding qualifier, your country of residence. A scan of the 33 European states available on the drop-down menu reminds us that the law doesn't apply to everybody. But even if it did, the bad news just can't be avoided. The links are only part of the problem. It's the data. And data is like air, all the Earth's air. Who can stop the air of Asia from blowing its way to North and South America and then on to Europe and Africa? And no, I don't want to hear from the climatologists who might tell me that I got my air travel paths all wrong. You have the picture. Like air, data just flows. One singular copy, and it can be replicated again and again and again. And there's no stopping it. Just as you can pass a law about the air of your country, and it doesn't protect you from the polluted air of your neighbors. Nobody tells Mother Nature what to do, and I'm beginning to believe that with today's interconnected computers and networking, nobody tells data what to do either. Listening to discussions such as these, I often detect an undertone of wanting to return to the good old days, when long ago and far away meant just that. But the internet is the distance killer, both in time and geography. I can as quickly find a pizza restaurant in San Francisco as in Rome or Buenos Aires, just standing on any single spot on the planet. While we can't escape the capability of billions of smartphones, I think we don't quite remember the way things were. My student ID card from graduate school had my picture, my social security number, and my home address. That's lots more information than you would consider putting on one now. But then, in the good old days, it wasn't connected to anything. the power of data replication has forever changed, just as the fluid presence of what's information is in constant flux. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, we look at the life of the famous Impressionist painter Claude Monet. Through determination and some lessons in technology, his greatest works came in his 70s and his 80s. Then on Biotech Nation, the new wearable. We'll hear about Cognition Kit and why that's valuable from consumers to pharmaceutical companies. Ross King's latest book focuses on the Impressionist artist Claude Monet. That's Claude Monet, M-O-N-E-T. It's different from the artist Edward Manet, M-A-N-E-T. Both are famous. Both of their works are familiar to you. So this being radio, I asked Ross to separate the work of the two artists visually in our minds.
I suppose Edward Manet, who was a little bit older, he was 8 years older, born in 1832, and Monet was born in 1840. When you think of Manet, think of Olympia, the famous painting of the naked woman reclining on the daybed, being brought a bouquet of flowers from an admirer waiting in the street below. Or think of Le Déjeuner sur l'herbe, the luncheon on the grass, the famous painting of the nude woman having luncheon with the two young men who...
A lot of nude women.
Exactly. A lot of naked women. And a lot of black in his paintings. Whereas Monet had no black. In fact, at Monet's funeral in 1926, supposedly they had shrouded his coffin with a black shroud. And his very good friend Georges Clemenceau, the former prime minister of France, grabbed off the black shroud and said, "No black for Monet," and put a colored cloth over top of it. Because Monet didn't use black in his, for the most part, in his paintings. His paintings are concerned with light, concerned with sparkling rivers and poppies and, of course, water lilies and things of that nature.
The wheat stalks. Is that what they're called? The wheat
Well, there's much debate. It's a good question. What are they called? They used to be called the haystacks, but then pedants pointed out that it's not actually hay, it's grain. And so they became grain stacks or wheat stacks. And in fact, I've got a long footnote on about page 25 or something of the book giving the, for anyone who cares at all to read it, giving all of the permutations over the years of what these paintings are called. But I'm sure your listeners can imagine them, these beautiful paintings of what to us, I suppose, look like haystacks under snow with the sun on them. Morning, at dusk, summer, winter.
Of summer.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. 5 minutes later than the last one, 10 minutes later.
Many lilies, many water lilies,
exactly.
Floating,
yes.
And bridges, and et cetera.
That's right. So beautiful French countryside, scenes of the French countryside.
Well, he was born in 1840 in Paris. And by the time he was in his sort of late 20s, we'll say the late 1860s, we'll say that he was part of that set of artistic rebels, you know, Renoir, Degas, Cézanne, you know, the Impressionists. And they were not well received.
No, they were scorned by the critics, mocked by the public. In fact, the public were so outraged at some of their paintings that, according to legend, puce-faced gentlemen in frock coats, you know, trying to give the paintings a damn good thrashing with their walking sticks. And they had to move some of Edouard Manet's paintings up high in the exhibition so that they wouldn't be subjected to acts of violence. And the collectors ignored them. Collectors didn't want to buy their work. And so they did have very difficult years in the 1860s. And then through the 1870s, they, of course, came together officially in 1874 as the Society of Independent Artists, which ultimately became known partly due to Claude Monet's 1872 painting, Impression Sunrise, which was shown at that 1874 exhibition. It became known as the Impressionists, and which was a kind of term of abuse initially. It's the reviewer said, these are not painters, these are impressionists, because they only paint impressions. Which in
with
fact,
disdain.
But in fact, that's what many of them did. And ultimately, within a couple of years, they embraced the term. And for anyone wishing to know more about that particular period in French artistic history, I modestly refer you to my book, The Judgment of Paris, which was published, I think, in 2006, and which I now think of as the prequel to my book on Claude Monet, which is sort of the end of the story.
So Monet broke out. At some point, his painting started to sell.
That's right. He was discovered by Gilded Age America. The beautiful thing for him that was missed out on by various of his colleagues is that he lived for a long time. He lived to be 86. And so he outlived the infamy and notoriety and scorn and derision and all of that. And so by the time he was in his in mid to late 40s and then through his 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, he really was celebrated as the greatest painter in France. In 1909, one of the French magazines called him the greatest painter we possess today. Some people said he was the greatest painter of all time. And he certainly, on the back of reviews like that and on the back of the popularity of his paintings with the public and collectors, became fabulously wealthy. And so really by 1900...
The wealthy became wealthier.
That's right, yes, yes. And he could thank Americans for that, because really from the late 1880s, collectors in America decided that they quite liked the Impressionist painters, and especially Claude Monet. I mean, there was a woman in Chicago, Bertha Palmer, Mrs. Potter Palmer, who went on a Monet buying spree in Europe and came back with 25 of Monet's paintings. And ultimately, she bought more than 90 of them. So once that gold rush started, Monet really enjoyed wealth as well as acclaim.
But how do you paint this many paintings? I mean, that was just some of them. Someone else you were mentioning, a collection, had many more, and people were buying 20. They were buying. How could he produce this many paintings?
Well, there was some fear initially in the late 1880s, early 1890s, when Monet was discovered in America, that France would be denuded of Monet paintings and that the Americans would get them all. The rapacity of the Yankees, one critic said, was going to steal all of the Monets from Europe. But in fact, there was little danger of that, because Monet was a painting machine, and he could produce work very quickly. He produced thousands of paintings in the course of his life. So in many ways, there was quite enough to go around for everyone. And he was a very shrewd businessman, which is...
Helpful.
Exactly, yes. And he had a very good dealer, Paul Durand-Ruel, who was based in Paris, but originally is the first one to take the Impressionist works to America, to New York in the late 1880s. And so Monet and Durand-Ruel, their partnership, which is a very fascinating one, made both of them ultimately very wealthy and really assisted the fortunes, the material fortunes of people like Monet and many of the other Impressionists in America.
To think about what it would cost to create a print in those days, that was a fabulously difficult process in itself. That was art in itself. We're talking about a time when this was it. You had to have the painting.
That's
or the
right.
pastel.
Yes, yeah. Yes. I'm not entirely sure when the four-color process was invented. Poster art, of course, became very famous and very important in the 1890s with the nabby painters like Vuillard and Bonnard and Toulouse-Lautrec, of course. Monet didn't do that sort of work, and there weren't really reproductions of his work done at that time. And so, yes, you had to have the real thing. You couldn't do like you do today and go and buy a beautiful Monet print. You had to have the actual thing on the wall.
Well, as a painter, he was totally frustrated trying to capture sort of the fleeting and ethereal nature of light and water and color. And when you think about it, the first thing I thought is like, well, too bad the poor guy didn't have an iPhone, you know?
Yeah, well,
like,
yes, exactly.
That's just, yeah. But then I realized, you know, when you look at water, what you're looking at is something moving. You're seeing light come, right? You're seeing all of these things. And we might have a memory of almost a picture. It's not what you see produced by a camera. It's different. We always see sort of tiny videos, and we don't really realize it.
That's right. And what Monet was trying to do was not simply to paint the object, not simply to paint the cliff on the coast of Normandy or the haystack or grain stack, whatever we want to call it, or the poplars or the river scene. He said it wasn't just the object that he was trying to paint. It was what surrounded the object and what really colored the object and colored the space between himself and the object. He said that one great quote he gives, he said, everything changes, even stone, because, of course, he did many very famous paintings in the early 1890s of the Cathedral of Rouen in northern France, in Normandy. And he showed it at various times of the day, at dawn, at sunset, through the seasons. And his point in these paintings really was that something as ancient and something made of stone, like a cathedral, has all sorts of different, literally different facades. He painted the facade many times, and every time it was different. He said the light changed every 7 minutes in Normandy, in northern France, and therefore he really wanted to record, whether it was the Cathedral of Rouen or whether it was the grain stacks, he wanted to effectively have a painting of each one of those for every 7 minutes of the day. In some ways, you could use Monet's paintings as a kind of sundial or something like that and calculate the time of day on which he painted something. In fact, people have done that with Impression Sunrise, the painting that I said gave the or is one of the paintings that gave the Impressionist their name that he did in 1872. People have sort of triangulated from the light and everything, where he was, which hotel he was in. Likewise in London, he did famous paintings of Westminster Bridge and the Houses of Parliament from the Savoy Hotel. So he didn't always work in the open air. He also worked in the comfort of the Savoy Hotel in London, looking out his window. And they were able, scientists were able to determine by triangulating, by calculating the time of day that he was there, or calculating the figuring out from the time of day he painted where exactly which hotel room in the Savoy he was occupying. And so Monet is sort of like a heliotrope or a sundial or something like that, or he wanted his paintings to function in that particular way.
We think of other artists just being painfully careful and angsting over a single canvas forever, and he had to get it done in 7 minutes or it was gone.
But that in itself caused him a lot of angst as well, because he worked very quickly. He had to work very quickly, but then he went back over it. And one of the myths that Monet spread about himself, or that was sort of adopted by people, was that he worked very quickly and he would go out and sit before the motif and paint, and then he would job done. He would go home after 3 or 4 hours and that would be the painting. But in fact, a friend who knew him very well and watched him paint many times said that he spent as many as 60 sessions on a particular painting. And some of the water lilies have as many as 15 layers of paint. So he repainted. It wasn't all just in one go out in the countryside. He went back to his often very commodious studio. By 1915, he had an enormous studio. He would go back there and do his work. And there are very funny stories about his working process. The American painter John Singer Sargent came to see him in London as he was doing his seven-minute paintings, or as the light and the fog in London changed every 7 minutes. And Monet had, according to Sargent, about 90 paintings in his hotel room. And suddenly he would need canvas 31 because the light effect of canvas 31 was suddenly breaking over the House of Parliament. So he'd flick through his canvases, find it, get it on the easel, start to paint. But of course, the light was then changing. He needed canvas 57. And so he would scramble to find it. Who knows? I mean, Sargent was a bit mischievous and told stories about Monet. Who knows how true that one is? But I think it does tell us, it maybe has a larger truth about Monet's working practices and what exactly his artistic aims were.
He certainly was trying to capture the reality, even though it was impression.
That's right. It was his impression. I think he was always adamant about that. It was the way he saw things. And fascinating thing about the way he saw things, perhaps, is that it was believed that he had, in his lifetime, this is, it was believed that he had, it was almost a more highly evolved human being than everyone else. It was thought that he was extra sensitive to colors at the ultraviolet end of the spectrum. And so it was believed that he could see colors and effects and nuances that the average person couldn't do. And so his gift to us then was to give us these paintings and where he saw things that, you know, we mortals were unable to see. And so sometimes people looked at his paintings, and including the painter André Durin. Durin admired Monet immensely, but he said, nature doesn't look like that. It's, you know, it's not that pretty. There aren't those colors in it. But in fact, Monet was adamant that those were the colors that he saw.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Ross King. You know him from such books as Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling, Leonardo and the Last Supper, Machiavelli and the Judgment of Paris. He's here today with Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet, and the Painting of the Water Lilies. Over time, the infirmities of the artistic rebels, they caught up with them. You know,
that's right.
Some of them passed on. Some of them had such infirmities that they simply couldn't be artists in the sense that they were before. And Monet continues on and is fine until his eyesight starts to fail.
That's right. At the end of Monet's life, his friend Georges Clemenceau said to him, "You've had the best life a man can have had." And I think in many ways that was true. And I would hope the cantankerous Monet agreed and accepted that, because he was more fortunate than so many of his contemporaries who either died prematurely, as in the case of Edouard Manet, who died in his early 50s in 1883, or they had infirmities, as you say, which prevented them from painting. Edgar Degas effectively went blind. He began losing his eyesight in the 1870s when he was still fairly young. And by the early years of the 20th century, he couldn't even read a newspaper. Mary Cassatt likewise had cataracts and went blind. Monet, in many ways, was blessed. He was blessed with this great talent and blessed with a great vision. And that continued right up into his 70s. He had very good health, despite the fact that he was a chain smoker. In some ways, he defied artistic gravity. He also defied the Surgeon General's warning and things like that with his chain smoking and his longevity. His eyesight finally began to fail in his early 70s. When he was approaching his 72nd birthday, he developed cataracts. And he did stop painting for a couple of years. He was also grieving because he lost his second wife. His first wife had died decades earlier. And his beloved second wife, Elise, died in 1911 when he was 71 years old. And he was devastated by that. And in the next year, he began losing his eyesight. And so that's the point at which he thought,
it's
he was
over.
72 years old. I'm finished. I haven't done it. I've done everything I can do. I haven't done everything I want to do. But my career is effectively over. And I think he could have looked to people like Degas, Renoir, who was still trying to paint, but he was very arthritic, Mary Cassatt, his friend Camille Pizarro, who had gone blind or had terrible difficulties before he died about a decade earlier than that. And so I think Monet looked at his friends and realized, I'm joining them. I'm going to become superannuated and I'm not going to be able to paint anymore. But the almost miraculous thing is he kept painting. Monet, in some ways, couldn't stop painting. He was like a shark who, you know, will die if it stops swimming. And Monet needed to keep painting in order to live, and so he did. And of course, the remarkable thing is that, in the first place, his eyesight either improved a bit, because for the next 5 or 6 years after he first was diagnosed with cataracts, he did not seem to have problems with his eyes. Or perhaps he modified his painting technique in order to accommodate the deterioration of his vision. But in any case, what he began doing in his early 70s, right through to his mid-80s, was to paint these absolutely massive canvases. If his career...
The giant paintings.
That's right. His career had been built hitherto on canvases that were about 3 feet wide by 2.5 feet high, which is the size of most paintings, most Impressionist canvases. But what Monet did was to aggrandize, to supersize his paintings, and possibly in part because of his eyesight, but I think also because of his ambition. He really wanted to make a mark with these paintings. And so from 1914 until 1926, he painted virtually nothing but his water lily pond on this massive scale, on canvases that were much taller than him. He stood maybe 5.5 feet tall, and these paintings are 6.5 feet tall, and they're on canvases, in many cases 14 feet wide, forming compositions that are in some cases over 40 feet wide. And so he produced in his last years, I mean, we can't call them his declining years because he was not declining. He produced in the last 12 years of his life these massive canvases, which really now are seen as his greatest contribution to art, greater even than those radical paintings he did in the 1860s and 70s when he was in his 20s and 30s.
I so loved reading this. Monet at 76, so he's still got another 10 years of massive production to go through here. He writes, "I'm getting old. I don't have a moment to waste."
That's right. He was an old man in a hurry, and he...
Every 7 minutes.
Exactly. He was very busy, and he sat by the side of the pond through the war years because he began the large-scale water lilies in 1914, which, of course, is the year that war broke out in Europe. And he sat beside his pond, which a friend of his called the luminous abyss into which he stared every day. He sat there for day after day, week after week, month after month, ultimately year after year, producing all of these enormous canvases. And he could barely ever be persuaded to budge. You can think of him as a kind of workaholic. He just would not leave the pond. He was so busy painting and trying to perfect what he was doing, that when he needed a haircut, he wouldn't even go to the local barber. The barber had to come to him and cut his hair as he painted. That's how busy he was. So he's sort of I sometimes talk of him as the Basil Fawlty of paintings because of the temper tantrums he threw. But in some ways, he was the Gordon Gekko of painting as well. And, you know, he did take lunch, but I think he believed lunch was for wimps maybe. And he was, you know, had all sorts of work to do down by the pond. And that's where he took himself every day at about 6 or 7 o'clock. And he put in his 8, 10, 12-hour shifts beside the pond or in his studio working on these massive paintings.
I've been speaking with Ross King, the author of Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet, and the Paintings of the Water Lilies. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, wearables that give you a clue as to the state of your cognitive abilities and why pharmaceutical companies are interested. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Ross King, the author of Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet, and the Painting of the Water Lilies. The subjects of all of these paintings are at this home with this wonderful garden just outside Paris.
That's right. He moved there. He moved to Giverny in 1883 when he was 43 years old, exactly halfway through his life. And it was really at the time that he was becoming recognized, and the money started coming in a couple of years later. And he was able to buy the property outright in 1890. He began renting it. He rented it for 7 years, but then bought it in 1890. And once he bought it, he was able to begin doing things to it. And so he began expanding it. He built himself a new studio in the 1890s, and then yet another studio in the in 1915, one of the largest studios in the history of art. And then, of course, the other thing he began doing was working on the garden. He took out the orchard that had been there. It was a sort of old-fashioned Norman farmhouse. It was had been a cider farm before he bought it. But he then transformed it into not something that would make economic make money for him through agriculture, as the previous owners had all done. But he was going to put in plants that had no monetary value in terms of their sale. But once he put them on canvas, once he transferred them to canvas, they were worth a lot of money. And so he put in his roses, his irises, his peonies. And of course, in the latter part of the 1890s, when he began building his pond just south of it, when he purchased more land, he began doing his water lilies, planting them and then ultimately painting them.
And it's still there today.
It's still there today, and it is faithfully restored. It had a few rough decades in the middle part of the 20th century after he died, but it really has been restored, beautifully restored. And so when you go there, you really do have a sense of his presence, both in the house. You can go into his bedroom and you can go into his kitchen where he entertained and where it said he served the best food in France. And of course, you can walk in his garden and also walk around the lily pond and walk across the bridges that he constructed. And so it's a really marvelous experience where Monet was not a spiritual person, so he would disagree with me when I say this, but I think his spirit still is there because you do really, I think we've all seen this garden so many times through the paintings, through the images.
Isn't that a jigsaw puzzle I'm looking at?
That's right. Yes, I had that poster on my wall in my first year of university. And so it's really marvelous when you go there because you do have this strange sense of deja vu. But as I say, you also have this strange sense of this old codger with the big white tobacco-stained beard sitting beside the pond.
But also in the house, people were always coming for lunch, and you see the wonderful table in the kitchen and looking out. And it's just like, oh, wouldn't you just love to be there?
Yes,
It's gorgeous. So you get a sense of the environment that he lived in all those years while he was painting. Very unusual to have that experience.
That's right. 43 years he spent there. 43, and he once he. By the turn of the 20th century, he almost never left that area. In 1901, he went to London. In 1908, he went to Venice. But really, it was difficult to get him to budge from there. He loved it. He loved Giverny. He loved his location. And he loved his house and garden. And really, after 1903, he did some Venice paintings. He finished his London paintings in Giverny, interestingly enough. He didn't always need to be in front of the motif. But in the 20th century, he did not, for the last 25 years of his career, he painted almost nothing but his garden. It really became his favorite subject, which he painted hundreds of times. One thing maybe not to lose sight of is just how unique that was to create yourself the landscape that you painted. Because generally what you did if you were a landscapist and what Monet had done previously through the course of the 19th century is you went and found a landscape. You took the boat out on the river, you hiked up into the mountains, you went to the seaside or something like that, and there it was. All you had to do was frame it, find a beautiful view, paint it, frame it, job done. But Monet constructed the landscape that he painted again and again and again. And he was absolutely meticulous about the planting, the way it had to look through the different seasons and so forth. And so in many ways, it's an artificial environment. And in the book, I discuss how it's an Oriental environment. It's not really a French environment. It looks quite alien because it isn't necessarily the French countryside. There are Japanese bridges and plants that are not native to France and the ones that are native to Japan, for example. And so it was, in many ways, it was a bizarre undertaking, almost a folly. And yet it was because he was so good at it, he's made it seem very natural to us.
Now, we can't really avoid the fact that he did try to get procedures for his eyes, for his cataract.
That's right.
And I must say that the cataract procedures in the 1920s were abysmal and frightening because, to me, he could have lost his eyesight completely.
Yes, and that was his greatest fear. People sometimes ask me, immersing myself in Monet's life or in the 15th century Italy, would I like to live then? And I say, yes, I would. If I could take my doctor and some antibiotics and a dentist and some anesthetics and things like that. And yes, I think anyone who has had cataract surgery recently should be
count
very
their
thankful.
Lucky stars.
Exactly. because it was, I do describe in the book, the three largely unsuccessful surgeries that he had. Mary Cassatt had five, which turned out even worse. And he had the best doctor in France. He had the best oculists coming and measuring his eyeball to try to get glasses that would work for him. And they're very poignant pictures of him. The man who was believed to have the best eye in the history of painting. Cézanne said, Monet is only an eye, but my God, what an eye. In the book, we put a picture of him lying in his hospital bed with his eyes bandaged because of the fact that he has had his first cataract operation in January 1923 when he was 82 years old. And it was largely unsuccessful, but he almost went, it was a kind of medical torture. He had to lie perfectly still for days on end without moving his head.
Drops of cocaine.
That's right.
In their
cocaine
eyes.
Was the anesthetic that was used, and it was said that if you were a heavy drinker, a guard should be stationed beside your bed because heavy drinkers, they knew there was some sort of a reaction with the cocaine that was given. It appears that Monet did have some sort of, I wouldn't say a psychotic reaction, but when his children or his stepchildren found out that there should have been a guard stationed by his bed, they were very upset because they realized that he had been put at risk almost needlessly. But he underwent these medical tortures very reluctantly because he thought maybe his eyes would just fade away and he would learn to accept that. But his greatest fear is that there would be the destruction of his eyes through the surgery, which was a real possibility.
Well, by the end, in his mid-80s, he was painting with one eye completely covered and very thick eyeglasses, for the other eye. And yet he painted these incredible curved panels to go into, is it the Orangerie?
That's right.
In Paris. So let's talk about that.
Yes, people came to see him after he had his operations in 1923. And he was quite happy to show his paintings to people. He began doubting how good they were. And he had a lot of black periods when he thought, A, that he wasn't able to paint because of his eyesight, and maybe possibly even worse, he couldn't judge what he had painted because of the fact that his eyesight was bad. And if you think of the project that he had set himself, it was almost insane that he was doing these 42-foot-wide compositions in which he had to have something at foot number one on the left-hand side harmonize with something 40 feet to the right.
And these were curved into two oval rooms.
Yes, that's the way he always wanted to have them shown, going around a wall. It was his dream to have, I guess, what we today would call an installation that would give viewers what today we would call an immersive experience. And Monet really is the first, maybe, installation artist or something like that, because what he wanted to do was create a kind of simulacrum or facsimile of his water lily pond and raise his water lily pond up from from its horizontal position and raise it vertically onto the wall. and allow us to sort of hover above it or be surrounded by it and enter into this magic world that he had created. But his eyesight, of course, that job was difficult enough for someone in his 20s, 30s, 40s. When he was a younger man, it would have been difficult. And so for someone in his 70s and 80s, who he was in robust physical shape for most of his life, despite all of his eating, drinking, and smoking, he had a great constitution, but his eyesight was failing. And so how did he manage all of the effects that he was trying to carry out across so many square feet of canvas? And that's really what led to his despair and depression in the mid-20s, when he was just unsure if what he was doing had any worth at all. And there's a wonderful quote that he gave to his friend Georges Clemenceau. He said, "When I'm dead, I'll be able to bear their imperfections." But while he was living, they would never be perfect for him, because of the fact that not just that his eyesight was deteriorating, but he was a perfectionist and drove himself almost to the point of despair and, as one of his friends said, the point of self-annihilation, trying to capture these evanescent effects. And difficult at any time, but when you're 83 years old and you've just had an unsuccessful cataract operation, even worse.
Well, just a few days after they came and picked up all these panels, he passed away.
That's right. He passed away in December 1926, maybe about 6 weeks past his 86th birthday. And it was only death made it possible to get these out of his clutches. He could not part with them. He didn't want to part with them. In the book I discuss, it might have been because of the fact that he wasn't able to judge their worth, but I think it was also there was an element of the Shroud of Penelope or the tales of Scheherazade in the 1001 Nights. This is the Grande Décoration, as he called it, the great decoration he was doing, this massive project he'd set for himself a dozen years earlier. If it ended, if he released those canvases, he would die. And so in many ways, he had to keep painting in order to keep living. And he developed a kind of obsession with them. But finally, yes, death made it so that the French state to which he had donated them was able to take away more than 100 yards of these, which were ultimately put into two elliptical rooms in the center of Paris, which is where he wanted them. He wanted a destination for them in the very heart of Paris, and he certainly got that, in the Orangerie, which had been I guess what we would call a multi-purpose venue for the previous couple of decades, and it was fitted out so it would accommodate these panels, and that's where they are.
You can see them today.
Exactly, a century later. Much, it has to be said, much more beautifully lit today than they were when it opened in 1927, and also, gratifyingly for the ghost of Monet, much, much better attended than it was in the late 1920s when it first opened.
Never appreciated in our own time, Ross.
That's right. Well, initially people thought they were an artistic failure. The first reviews were bad ones. They said this is the work of an old man, that Monet had committed artistic suicide, and that this was the pitiful crowning of his career. But of course, fairly quickly, opinions reversed themselves. And certainly by the 1950s, these paintings were being celebrated, not just the ones in Paris in the Orangerie, but also the ones that had remained for several decades unsold in his studio, where his son was the owner, his son Michel, owned them. And Michel suddenly made a fortune by the 1950s selling them to museums, because suddenly there was enormous interest in these late works of Monet.
Well, Ross King, you're the king of the backstory. I got to tell you.
I'm the king of the irrelevant anecdote.
Oh, we love it. We love it. Page after page. Please come back. See us anytime.
I'd love to. Thank you, Moira.
My guest today is Ross King. The book is Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet and the Painting of the Water Lilies. It's published by Bloomsbury. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, upping the game on wearables. Noah Koenig from Cambridge Cognition and Ben Frenette from the Control Group, both in Cambridge, England. They joined me to talk about their new company, Cognition Kit. I started out by asking Noah what part Cambridge Cognition played in this joint venture.
So we are developers of near-patient cognitive assessment technology. So by that I mean cognitive tests delivered on touchscreen devices like iPads, tablets, for use primarily in clinical trials, but also by clinicians too. So for the last sort of 15, 20 years, we've been developing these tests for clinical practice use, for showing efficacy in CNS disorders of drugs in clinical trials. But we've never really taken that technology and delivered it for end users. And what we're seeing is, you know, an increase in the number of people who are taking a real interest in their own personal health. So in the likes of your Fitbits for physical health, we see an area where people would be interested in being able to do the same thing for their mental health, but also to help provide the drug companies, pharmaceutical companies, with richer data using new technology which can be delivered to the end user. But we didn't have any experience in that, so that's where we engaged with Ben and with Control Group to help set up this new venture.
Before we get into that, what kind of things were you measuring?
So all aspects of cognition, and by that I mean things such as episodic memory and where you left your keys.
Oh, I would fail.
Yeah. So, for example, we help a lot in clinical trials of Alzheimer's disease, which is looking at episodic memory, but also other CNS disorders such as schizophrenia, ADHD, depression. All of these disorders and diseases have an element of cognitive impairment as a key part of them. So by using our tests, our assessments, we're able to test very specific elements of the brain which relate to particular neural systems, such as the hippocampus is which controls your short-term memory, so episodic memory. So we have a number of assessments which are very precisely linked to performance of the hippocampus. So we can see if someone is perhaps showing signs of early stage Alzheimer's. But then other tests for things like attention, reaction time, processing speeds, all these things, everything that that you do, that you know, the brain is involved in, has an element of cognitive process and cognitive function. So it's measuring all of those things, but to a very specific and precise level.
Give us a specific example of what you might measure automatically that the person doesn't even know is being measured.
The pharmaceutical companies will be measuring cognitive function, and the way that they do that is using these different tests, which are, for example, looking at your recognition of a pattern that you saw maybe a couple of patterns ago. So have you seen the symbol before? Where did you see this symbol? How quickly can you react to responding to see whether or not you have seen that symbol? Most of our tests are non-linguistic, so they're based upon pictures, patterns, almost game-like, so that there's no bias of your culture or your language. The advances in technology, such as wearables, playing a key role in opening the door for more regular monitoring and measurement of your cognitive and mental well-being.
And you can only take it so far. You needed to be able to take it into the field. And that's where Control Group came in.
Hi.
Hi, Ben.
We're aware of the great work that Cambridge Cognition do together with clinicians, together with the pharma industry. Our work at Control Group is doing a user-centered design, iterative user-centered design, research and build of software products which can help people live their daily lives. And as part of that, we see a coming together of the type of things that people are creating to help people with their health and the way of assessing health. And cognitive assessment is a key part of that jigsaw. There's lots of people using wearables to assess their fitness, using wearables to assess lots of other things, and people are very comfortable now wearing technology that does these things. The trick that we have with Cambridge Cognition is to create things that can work on wearable and mobile devices and allow people to assess their own cognitive capabilities.
Now, you're the founder of Control Group, and you're a psychologist, and there are many psychologists, I presume, working there. So you start with psychology.
We start with understanding people, yeah, and understanding what they do. And we think there's a big difference between the type of assessment you can do when you ask someone to come to a doctor's surgery or come to a clinic and assess their cognitive capability, assess their working memory once every 3 months. So what you might be able to do if you can do it on the device that they're wearing, whether that be an Apple Watch or whether that be a Fitbit tracker or whether that be their Android device. So if you can start to assess these things day to day in people's lives, the way that you design that assessment needs to be completely different. So that's where we build on the all of the assessments that Cambridge Cognition have developed over the last 30 years and make them work on wearable and mobile devices for people in their own homes. So we remove the clinical setting and allow people to do these things on a daily basis, which means rather than getting one assessment of cognitive health every 3 months, you can get an assessment of cognitive health every day and build up a far richer picture of their cognitive capability and how it develops over time.
What are people willing to do and what are people not willing to do?
That's exactly what we've got to find out. So by developing things iteratively, we create something which we believe will work for people, and then we give it to them. We put it in their hands. These are prototypes, and they were called sacrificial prototypes because we don't care whether they work or not, really. We just want to use them as tools to find out what people do. We can find out a great deal from this, and then we can create the next version of that thing. So we need to rapidly develop these tools, give them to people, see what they do, and everyone's going to react differently. So someone might be willing to do something every day, other people every week. But if we can develop something that can be used in different way for different people and in different circumstances, then it stands a far greater chance of capturing this rich data set. The applications of this are really broad. You know, this can work for pharma, biotech industry for use in clinical trials and clinical assessment. This can be used as a conversation between a healthcare practitioner and their patient or an insurer and their customer, but equally it can be built into consumer products. So the idea is it's a software platform that can be interpreted and used by lots of different people. And there's so much possible work to do there. So the clinical scientists at Cambridge Cognition and our designers, researchers and developers have so much possible work to do. It was just really exciting to start getting on with the work and, you know, forming a company that would allow us to do that quickly.
So you've kept your own company, but you have a new company.
Exactly.
Called Cognition Kit.
Yeah.
And you own it 50%, 50-50.
Correct.
And it's going to go along and focus on these products.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and we focused initially, as Ben said, there's so much potential for measuring cognition, mental health in all sorts of different applications. So where do we start? And we just started looking at where's there a big need at the moment. So initially, we've developed a little prototype using a wearable which captures all sorts of sensor data, such as your skin response, your heart rate, etc., and pairing that with a short selection of cognitive tests and a mood test as well to see how you're feeling at that particular time. And then pairing all of that data together to give this much richer, fuller picture of the person's overall mental well-being and looking at the different factors which contribute to how they're feeling at that time and how they're performing cognitively as well. So whether or not someone's had a good night's sleep, how stressed they are that day, how much physical activity they've had, all these factors could have a change moment to moment, which previously wouldn't have been captured if you're assessing someone once a month or once every 6 months. So we're using these wearables, this new technology now, to be able to capture this information continuously and to refine, to iterate, improve the product and build it around the end user so that it's something that they enjoy doing, something that they're getting feedback back from themselves, and that then, you know, the healthcare providers, the pharmaceutical companies, the insurers can gather this data as well and to intervene if someone's health starts to decline or to suggest ways in which they can improve.
Now, how do you test somebody's mood?
So there's a number of ways, But we've gone for just a really simple route to start with, which is it's asking them. You know, you've got someone at a particular time when they're feeling, their mood is a particular way and they're at a particular level of stress. So you've got their cognitive performance then. So we then want to look at how they perform at a different time point when they're feeling slightly differently and build this rich, rich picture of an overall person and their overall cognitive and mental health.
With all this iteration on research, I mean, how close are you to a product?
Well, we have something that which we're using internally now, and we've demoed that to people. So there's this, as Noah was saying, there's this emotional response test which we've built onto Apple Watch. There's this other test of cognitive function which we've built onto a Microsoft Band, and the Microsoft Band has a lot of other capabilities in it. So as mentioned, galvanic skin response, heart rate, ambient temperature. Both of those things are working demos, and we're building up data sets about how effective they are, and then we can rationalize that back against existing tests to see how accurate those assessments are, and then we can start to apply them. The nature of this kind of iterative development is that you're never really there. You're always improving, and we are always improving, and just trying to do that as quickly as possible. There's a few companies who've approached us already who want to use these things. It makes perfect sense for them to reduce the cost of having the clinicians and having the clinics and give people the tools to assess their own cognitive capability. So the market's definitely there, and we're just kind of responding directly to those opportunities.
Well, I have to say, I'm really thinking about all of those people out there developing apps for, as you were saying, Apple Watches,
yeah,
and Fitbits, and you name it, your Android phones, your iPhones. There are so many things people are doing that you could partner with. You have to cross these capabilities to come up with a much richer functionality.
Yeah, exactly. And the partners are out there, and they're already starting to come forward. It's a very new field for them to, we're encouraging people to come forward, to talk to us, to start those conversations. Cognition Kit itself came out of a partnership, and partnerships are crucial to get things where they need to be. So whether it's pharmaceutical companies or consumer or healthcare companies, there's so much that could be done in this area. So if they can come to us through at Cognition Kit on Twitter or cognitionkit.com and get in touch, that would be fantastic.
Hey, thank you. Please come back and let us know how it develops.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Noah Koenig is the Director of Product Marketing at Cambridge Cognition, and Ben Fenert is the founder of the Control Group and Director of Cognition Kit. More information is available on the web at cognitionkit.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.